They won't understand the real reason why. I'll be able to sleep okay with the kids there to protect me. They pound on my chest if I have a nightmare. Kyle finally smiled.
You're an unusual man, Alex.
You're both incredibly open and secretive. Getting more unusual every day, I said to Kyle. You come on a new monster one of these days. Don't bother to call. I'm monstered out. I stared into his eyes, trying to make contact and not completely succeeding. Kyle was secretive, too. Not very open with anybody that I knew of.
I'll try not to call, Kyle said. You rest up, though. There's a monster working in the city of Chicago right now. Another in Lincoln and Concord, Massachusetts. Someone very evil is taking children in Austin, Texas. Little babies, actually. Repeat killers in Orlando and Minneapolis.
We've still got work here, I reminded Kyle.
Do we?
He asked, his voice dripping with irony.
What work is that, Alex? You mean spade work?
Kyle Craig and I watched the terrifying scene that was unfolding near the underground house. 70 to 80 men were busy digging up the meadow west of the disappearing house. They were working with heavy pickaxes and shovels, searching for bodies of murder victims. Spade work.
Since 1981, beautiful and intelligent women from all over the South had been abducted by the two monsters and murdered. It was a 13-year reign of horror.
First I fall in love with a woman, then I simply take her. Will Rudolph had written that in his diaries out in California. I wondered if the sentiment was his or his twin's. I wondered how badly Casanova was missing his friend now, how he grieved, how he planned to cope with his loss.
Did he already have a plan?
I believe that Casanova had met Rudolph sometime back around 1981. They had shared their forbidden secret. They liked to kidnap, to rape, and sometimes to torture women. Somehow they came up with the idea of keeping a harem of very special women, women who were bright and fascinating enough to hold their interest. They never had anyone to share their secrets with before. Then suddenly they had each other. I tried to imagine never having anyone to confide in, never once in your life, and then finding someone to talk to when you are 21 or 22 years old. The two of them had played their wicked games, gathered their harem of beauties in the Research Triangle area, and throughout the Southeast. My theory on twinning had been close to the truth. They enjoyed kidnapping and holding beautiful women captive. They also competed. So much so that Will Rudolph finally had to go off on his own for a while, to Los Angeles. He had become the gentleman caller out there. He'd tried to make it on his own. Casanova, the more territorial of the two, continued to work in the South. But they communicated. They shared stories. They needed to share. Sharing their exploits was part of the thrill for both of them. Rudolph eventually told stories to a reporter at the Los Angeles Times. He tasted fame and notoriety, and he liked it. Not so Casanova. He was much more of a loner. He was the genius, the creative one, I believed. I thought I knew who he might be. I thought that I'd seen Casanova without his mask. I kept drifting in and out of strange private thoughts at the dizzying crime scene. I was burnt toast, but that didn't matter anymore. It hadn't mattered for a while. Casanova, the territorial killer, I was thinking. He was probably still in the area around Durham and Chapel Hill. He had met Will Rudolph around the time of the Golden Couple murders. So far, he'd thought everything through with almost perfect clarity. He had finally made a mistake during the shootout 2 days before. A small mistake, but that was all it took sometimes. I thought I knew who Casanova might be, but I couldn't share it with the FBI. I was their loose cannon, right? The outsider on this case, so be it. Pal Craig and I watched the same distant spot in the high-waving grass and honeysuckle, out where the digging was taking place. Mass graves, I thought, as I watched the horrific scene. What a concept for the 90s. A tall, balding man stood up from his deep hole in the soft earth. He waved long arms high over his head, which was shiny with sweat.
"Bob Shaw here,"
he called out his name in a loud, clear voice. The digger's name was the verbal signal that another woman's body had been found. An entire corps of North Carolina medical examiners was at the dreamlike, unbearably grisly scene. One of the M.E.s ran over to the digger in a strange, lopsided waddle that would have made Kyle and me laugh under different circumstances. He gave Shaw a hand out of the grave. The TV cameras at the scene moved in on Shaw, who was U.S. Army from Fort Bragg. An attractive woman reporter nearby received a dab of makeup before she spoke into the lens of a camera.
"They've just found victim number 23, the reporter said, with appropriate solemnity. "All the victims so far appear to have been young women. The grisly murders..."
I turned away from the TV coverage, and I had to sigh out loud. I thought of children like my own Damon and Janelle watching this spectacle in their homes. This was a world they were inheriting. Human monsters roaming the earth, a majority of them in America and Europe. Why was that? Something in the water? In the high-fat fast food? On Saturday morning TV? "Go to hell home, Alex," Kyle said to me. "It's over now. You won't catch him, I promise you."
Chapter 115. Never say never. That's one of my few mottos as a cop. My body was bathed in a cold sweat. My pulse was jumpy and irregular. This was it, wasn't it? I needed to believe that it was. I waited in the hot, still darkness outside a small wood-shingled house in the Edgemont section of Durham. It was a typical middle-class southern neighborhood. Nice middle-class houses, American and Japanese cars in about equal numbers, mower-striped lawns, familiar cooking smells. It was where Casanova had chosen to live for the past 7 years. I had spent the early part of that night at the offices of the Herald Sun. I had reread everything written in the newspaper about the unsolved murders of Roe Tierney and Tom Hutchinson. A name mentioned in the Herald Sun helped put it together for me, confirmed my suspicions and fears, anyway. Hundreds of hours of investigating, reading and rereading, Durham police briefs. Then, pay dirt on a single line of newsprint. The name was in a story lost in the Durham newspaper's middle pages. It appeared just once. I found it anyway. I had stared for a long time at the familiar name in the news article. I thought about something I'd noticed during the shootout in Chapel Hill. I thought about the whole subject of perfect crimes. It all fit together for me now. Game, match, set, bingo. Casanova had blinked just once. I had seen it with my own eyes, though. The name in the news article was verification. It materially linked Will Rudolph and Casanova for the first time. It also explained to me how they had met and why they had talked. Casanova was sane and completely responsible for his actions. He had planned every step in cold blood. That was the most horrifying and unusual thing about the long trail of crimes. He knew what he was doing. He was a slime who had chosen to abduct beautiful young students in their prime. He'd chosen to rape and murder again and again. He was obsessed with perfect young women, with loving them, as he called it. I conducted an imaginary interview with Casanova as I waited outside his house in the car. I could see his face as clearly as the numbers on the dashboard. "You don't feel anything one way or the other, do you?"
"Oh, I do. I feel elation. I feel the most tremendous high when I take another lady. I feel varying levels of excitement, anticipation, animal lust. I feel an incredible sense of freedom that most people will never feel. But not guilt."
I could see him smirk as I sat in my car. I'd seen that smirk before, in fact. I knew who he was.
"Nothing that would make me want to stop."
"Was there any nurturing, any love given and received when you were a boy?"
"They tried. I wasn't really a boy, though. I don't remember acting or thinking like a boy."
I had begun to think like the monsters again. I was the dragon slayer. I hated the responsibility. I also hated the part of me that was becoming a monster. There was nothing I could do to stop it at this point. I was outside Casanova's house in Durham. Hammers of fear tapped lightly in my heart. I waited there for 4 nights. No partner, no backup. No problem whatsoever. I could be as patient as he was. I was hunting now. Chapter 116. I sucked in a harsh, deep breath and felt a little lightheaded. There he was. Casanova was leaving the house. I watched his face, watched his body language. He was confident, very sure of himself. Detective Davy Sykes sauntered out to his car at a little past 11 on the fourth night. He was a powerful man, athletic. He wore jeans, a dark windbreaker, high-topped black sneakers. Sykes climbed into a 10- or 12-year-old Toyota Cressida he kept in the garage. The sedan had to be his cruising car, his troller, his anonymous pickup vehicle. Perfect crimes. Davy Sykes definitely had the know-how. He was a detective on the case, and had been for over a dozen years. He'd known the FBI would investigate every local policeman when they entered the case. He had been ready with his perfect alibis. Sykes had even altered the date of a kidnapping to prove he was out of town when it happened. I wondered if Sykes would dare to go after another woman now. Had he been out carefully stalking and hunting already? What was he feeling now? What was he thinking right at this moment, I wondered, as I watched the dark Toyota back out of the driveway in suburban Durham. Was he missing Rudolph? Would he continue their game, or maybe stop now? Could he stop the game? I wanted him so badly. Samson had said at the beginning that this case was too personal for me. He was right on. No case had ever been more personal for me, not even close to this. I tried to think the way he might. I tried to get into his rhythm. I suspected that he had already picked out a victim, even if he didn't dare take her yet. Would she be another smart, beautiful college student? Maybe he would change his pattern now. I doubted it. He loved his life, his creation, too much. I followed the human monster down dark, deserted streets in southwest Durham. Blood pumped loudly through my head. I couldn't hear much of anything else. I drove with my headlights off for as long as Davy Sykes stayed on the side streets. Maybe he was just headed to the Circle K for cigarettes and beer. I thought that I had finally figured out what had happened back in 1981, that I had probably solved the Golden Couple murder which had shocked the university community here and in Chapel Hill. Will Rudolph had planned and committed the violent sex murders while he was a student. He had loved Ro Tierney, but she was interested in football stars. Detective Davy Sykes had met and questioned Rudolph during the subsequent police investigation. At some point, he had begun to share his own dark, forbidding secrets with the brilliant medical student. They had known about each other, felt it, sensed it. Both of them desperately wanted to share their secret need with someone. Suddenly, they had each other. Twinning. Now, I had killed his only friend. Did Davy Sykes want to kill me for that? Did he know I was coming for him? What was he thinking right at this moment? I didn't just want to catch him. I needed to capture his thoughts. Casanova turned onto Interstate 40 and headed south. He was traveling toward Garner and McCullers, according to bright white-on-green road signs. There was relatively heavy traffic on the interstate, and I was able to follow him in a safe cluster with 4 or 5 other cars. So far so good. Detective against detective. He got off at exit 35, which was boldly marked for McCullers. He'd gone a little over 30 miles. It was approaching 11:30 at night, the witching hour. I was going to take him out tonight, no matter what. I had never done that before, not in all my time as a homicide detective in Washington. This time, it was personal. Chapter 117. A mile from the exit ramp off 41, a Ford pickup truck swerved out of a hidden driveway. It was unexpected, but good luck for me. The dull red truck fell in between Sykes and me, offering me some cover. Not much, but enough for a few more miles. The Cressida finally pulled off the main road a couple of miles outside McCullers. Sykes parked in the crowded lot of a bar called the Sports Page Pub. One more car that wasn't likely to be noticed. That was what had begun to give him away. It was why even Kyle Craig had been on my list of suspects. Casanova seemed to have known every move the police would make before they made it. He had probably abducted some of the women by coming up to them as a police officer. Detective Davy Sykes. He had gone into a professional shooting crouch that afternoon on the street in Chapel Hill. I knew he was another cop. When I searched through the newspaper articles on the Golden Couple murder, I had spotted his name. Sykes had been a young cop on the original investigation team. He had interviewed a student named Will Rudolph back then, but he never mentioned it to any of us, never let on that he had met Will Rudolph in 1981. I passed by the Sports Page pub and pulled off the road as soon as I turned the next bend. I got out of the car and hurried back toward the bar. I was in time to see Davy Sykes cross the highway on foot. Casanova walked along the side of an intersecting side road with his hands thrust into his trouser pockets. He looked as if he belonged in the small-town neighborhood. Stun gun in one of those deep pockets, sport? Feeling the familiar burning itch now? The thrill is back? I followed Sykes into a pine-wooded lot, and he began to move quicker. He was fast for a big man. He could lose me now. Somebody's life would be at risk in the peaceful neighborhood. Another Scoochie Cross, another Kate McTiernan. I remembered Kate's words. Drive a stake through his heart, Alex. I slid the Glock 9mm out of my shoulder holster. Light, efficient, semi-automatic, 12 deadly shots. My teeth were gritted so tight they hurt. I clicked off the safety. I was ready to take Davy Sykes out. I eyed the ominous shapes of overhanging pine branches as I moved along. An A-frame house was up ahead, set against the backdrop of a full, pale yellow moon. I moved quickly across the soft floor of pine needles. I made no sound. I had his tempo and rhythm down now. I saw Casanova rapidly approaching the A-frame house, gaining speed. He knew his way. He'd been here before, hadn't he? He had been here to scope things out, to study the next victim, to get it just right. I sprinted up closer to the house. Then I couldn't see him. I'd lost him for a second. He might have slipped inside. A single shimmering light had been left on in the house. My heart was going to explode if I didn't blow him up first. My finger was on the semi-automatic's trigger. Drive a stake through his heart, Alex. Chapter 118. Take Sykes out. I fought to control my emotions, to find the calm pool inside me, as I ran toward a screened-in back porch that lay in shifting shadows and darkness. Suddenly I could hear the sputtering hum of an air conditioner inside. I noticed a peeling sticker on the whitewashed porch door. It read, "I live for Girl Scout cookies." He'd found another nice one out here, hadn't he? He was going to take her tonight. The beast couldn't stop himself.
"Hello, Cross. Now put down the gun. Very slowly, Ace," said the deep voice behind me in the dark. Both my eyes closed for a beat. I lowered the pistol, then dropped it on the lawn of grass and pine needles. My body felt like an elevator car in free fall. "Turn around now, you son of a bitch. You meddling shithead." I turned and looked into the face of Casanova. He was finally right there, close enough for me to touch. He had a Browning semi-automatic aimed at my chest. There would be no more overthinking, just gut instincts, I told myself. I let my right leg buckle as if I'd lost my footing. Then I sucker-punched Sykes to the side of his head. It was a hard shot, a crushing, heavyweight-caliber punch. Sykes went down on one knee, but he came back up in a hurry. I grabbed the front of his jacket and bounced him off the wall of the house. His arm cracked against the shingles, and the handgun fell loose. The ground was firm under my feet, and I moved in on him again. The moment had the feeling of a good old-fashioned street fight. I wanted it. My body ached for physical contact and release. "Come on, fucker," he challenged me. He wanted me, too. "Oh, don't worry," I told him. "I'm coming." Another light flashed on inside the house.
"Who's out there?"
The sound of the woman's voice caught me off guard.
"Who is out there, please?"
He threw an arcing roundhouse punch. Pretty good speed and aim. He was a decent fighter, not just a lover. I remember that Kate said he was scarily strong. I didn't plan to spend a lot of time in his killer grasp, though. I caught his punch on my upper arm, and it instantly went numb. He was powerful, all right. Stay away from his strength, I warned myself. Hurt him, though, hurt him a lot. I fired a hard right uppercut into his lower stomach. I thought of Kate and the beating she had taken for being disobedient. I vividly remembered the final beating she'd gotten. I crunched another right hand into his stomach. I felt the stomach soften. I think I hit him below the belt. Sykes groaned and slumped over like a badly beaten club fighter. It was a trick, a slick feint on his part. He fired a punch and caught the side of my head.
He rang my bell pretty good. I snorted, bobbed a little, showed him he hadn't hurt me. This was street fighting D.C. style. Come on, white boy. Come to me, monster man. I needed this time with him so much. I slammed my fist hard into his lower stomach again. Kill the body and the head dies. I wanted to mess up the head, too. I hit him for good measure in the nose, my best effort so far. Samson would have been proud of the shot. I was. That's for Samson, I told him through gritted teeth. He asked me to give you that. Hand deliver it. I hit him in the throat and he started to gag. I continued to bob. I didn't just look a little like Ali. I could fight like him when I had to. I could defend what needed to be defended. I could be a street tough when it had to be that way. This is for Kate. I hit Sykes in the nose again, right on the button, then square in the left eye with another right lead. His face was puffing up nicely. Drive a stake through his heart, Alex. He was strong and well-conditioned and still dangerous, I knew. He came at me again, charged like a raging bull in Plaza de Toros. I stepped aside and he forearmed the wall of the house as if he were trying to level it. The small house rumbled and shook. I punched Sykes hard on the side of his head. His head snapped back so hard against the house's aluminum siding that he left a dent in it. He was weaving now, his breath coming in gasps. Suddenly there were wails of sirens in the distance. The woman inside must have called the police. I was the police, wasn't I? Somebody hit me from behind, hit me real hard. Oh, Jesus, no, I moaned and tried to shake off the hurt. This wasn't possible. This couldn't be happening. Who had hit me? Why? I didn't get it, couldn't understand, couldn't clear my head fast enough. I was dizzy and hurt, but I turned anyway. I saw a frizzy-haired blonde woman wearing an oversized farm-made T-shirt. She was still holding the work shovel she'd just clobbered me with. "Get off my boyfriend!" she screamed at me. Her face and neck were beet red. "Get away from him, or I'll hit you again! You get away from my Davy!" My Davy? Jesus, my head was spinning, but I got the message. I thought I did anyway. Davy Sykes had come out here to see his girlfriend. He wasn't hunting anyone. He wasn't here to murder anyone. He was Farmaid's boyfriend. Maybe I'd lost it, I thought, as I backed away from Sykes. Maybe I was finally burned beyond a crisp, beyond recognition or redemption. Or maybe I was like almost every other homicide detective I knew, overworked and fallible as hell. I'd made a mistake. I'd been wrong about Davy Sykes. I just didn't understand how it had happened. Kyle Craig arrived at the house in McCullers within the hour. He was as calm as ever, completely unruffled. He spoke quietly to me. Detective Sykes has been having an affair with the woman in the house for over a year. We knew about it. Detective Sykes isn't a suspect. He isn't Casanova. Go home, Alex. Just go home now. You're through here. Chapter 119. I didn't go home. I went to visit Kate at Duke University Medical Center. She didn't look good. She was pale and haggard. She was rail thin. She didn't sound good either, but Kate was much, much improved. She was out of the coma. "Look who's finally awake," I said from the doorway into her room. "You got one of the bad guys, Alex," Kate whispered as she saw me. She smiled faintly, and she spoke in a slow, uncertain way. It was Kate, but not quite Kate. "Did you see that in your dreams?" I asked her. "Yep." She smiled again, that sweet smile of hers. She was talking so very slowly. "As a matter of fact, I did." "I brought you a little present," I told her. I held up a teddy bear, dressed to look like a doctor. Kate took the bear and she continued to grin. The magical smile almost made her look like her old self. I put my head down close to Kate's. I kissed her swollen head, as if it were the most delicate flower ever put on the earth. Sparks flew, strange ones, but maybe the strongest ones yet. "I missed you more than I can say," I whispered against her hair.
"Say it,"
she whispered back. Then she smiled again. We both did. Her speech was a little slow, maybe, but not her mind.
10 days later, Kate was up on a clumsy four-legged metal walker. She was complaining that she hated the mechanical contraption and would be off it within a week. Actually, it took her almost 4 weeks, but even that was considered miraculous. She had a half-moon indentation on the left side of her forehead from the terrible beating. So far, she had refused plastic surgery to repair it. She thought her dent added character. In a way, it did. It was pure, unadulterated Kate McTiernan. "It's also part of my life story, so it stays," she said. Her speech was closer to normal, getting a little clearer every week. Whenever I saw Kate's half-moon dent, I was reminded of Reginald Denny, the truck driver who was so savagely beaten during the Los Angeles riots. I remember how he looked after the first Rodney King verdict. Denny's head was severely dented, actually staved in on one side. It still looked that way when I saw him on TV a year after the incident. I also thought of a Nathaniel Hawthorne short story called The Birthmark. The dent was Kate's one imperfection. With it, in my eyes, anyway, she was even more beautiful and special than she'd been before. I spent most of July at home with my family in Washington. I took 2 short trips back to see Kate in Durham, but that was all. How many fathers get to spend a month with their kids catching up with their wild and woolly run through childhood? Damon and Janie were both playing organized baseball that summer. They were still music, movie, general noise, and hot chocolate chip cookie addicts. They both slept on the quilt with me for the first week or so, while I was recuperating, while I was trying to forget my recent time spent in hell. I worried that Casanova would come after me for killing his best friend, but so far there was no sign of him. No more beautiful women had been abducted in North Carolina. It was absolutely certain now that he wasn't Davy Sykes. Several area policemen had been investigated, including his partner Nick Ruskin, and even Chief Hatfield. Every cop had alibis, and they all checked out. Who the hell was Casanova, then? Was he going to just disappear like his underground house? Had he gotten away with all those horrifying murders? Could he just stop killing now? My grandmother still had volumes of psychological and other kinds of useful advice for me to follow. Much of it was directed at the subject of my love life, and my leading a normal life, for a change. She wanted me to go into private practice, anything but police work. "The children need a grandmother, and a mother," Nana Mama told me from the pulpit of her stove where she was fixing her breakfast one morning. "Should I go out and look for a mother for Damon and Janie? That what you're telling me?" "Yes, you should, Alex. And maybe you should do it before you lose your boyish good looks and charm."
"I'll get right on it," I said.
"Snare a wife and mother this summer." Nana Mama swatted me with her spatula, swatted me again for good measure. "Don't get smart with me," she said. She always had the last word. The phone call came around 1 o'clock one morning in late July. Nana and the kids had gone up for the night. I was playing some jazz piano, amusing myself, keeping a few junkies out on Fifth Street up with the music of Miles Davis and Dave Brubeck. Kyle Craig was on the phone line. I groaned when I heard Kyle's calm, subaltern voice. I expected bad news, of course, but not the particular news that I got that night. "What the hell is it, Kyle?" I asked him right off, trying to make his unexpected call into a joke. "I told you not ever to call me again." "I had to call on this, Alex. You had to know," he hissed over the long-distance lines. "Now listen to me closely." Kyle talked to me for almost half an hour, and it wasn't what I expected. It was much, much worse. After I got off the phone with Kyle, I went back to the sun porch. I sat there for a long time, thinking about what I should do now. There was nothing I could do. Not a thing. "It doesn't stop," I whispered to the four walls. "Does it?" I went and got my pistol. I hated carrying it inside the house. I checked all the doors and windows in our house. Finally, I went to bed. I heard Kyle's fateful words again as I lay in my darkened bedroom. I heard Kyle tell me his shocker. I saw a face I never wanted to see again. I remembered everything. "Gary Sonajay escaped from prison, Alex. He left a note. The note said he'd stop by and see you sometime soon." "It doesn't stop."
I lay in bed and thought about the fact that Gary Sonogy still wanted to kill me. He'd told me so himself. He'd had time in prison to obsess about how, when, and where he was going to do it. I finally went off to sleep. It was almost morning. Another day was starting. It really doesn't stop. Chapter 120. There were still two mysteries that had to be solved, or at least dealt with, in a better way. There was the mystery of Casanova, and who he was, and there was the one featuring Kate and myself. Kate and I visited the Outer Banks in North Carolina for 6 days at the end of August. We stayed near a picturesque resort town called Nag's Head. Kate's clumsy metal walker was gone, though she did carry around a knobby old-fashioned hickory cane at times. Mostly she practiced karate exercises with the hardwood cane. She used it as a karate stick on the beach, twirling the cane around her body and head with great dexterity and skill. Watching Kate, I thought that she looked almost luminescent. She was back in good form. Her face was close to the way it had been, except for the dent. "It's my stubborn streak," she told me, "and it's permanent until the day I die." It was an idyllic time in many ways. Everything seemed just right for us. Kate and I felt that we both deserved a holiday and much more. We ate breakfast together every morning on a porch made from long gray planks which overlooked the shimmering Atlantic. I made breakfast on my mornings to cook. Kate went to the Nag's Head Market and brought home sticky buns and Bavarian cream donuts on her days. We went for long, long walks along the shoreline. We surf-cast for blues and cooked the fresh fish right there on the beach. Sometimes we just watched the shiny boats patrolling the water. We took a day trip to watch the crazy-ass hang gliders off the high dunes in Jockey's Ridge State Park. We waited on Casanova. We were daring him to come after us. So far he wasn't interested. At least he didn't seem to be. I thought of the book and movie The Prince of Tides. Kate and I were a little bit like Tom Wingo and Susan Lowenstein, only mixed together in a different, though equally complex, way. Lowenstein had brought out Tom Wingo's need to feel and give love, I remembered. Kate and I were learning everything about each other, the important things, and we were both quick learners. Early one August morning, we waded into the clear, deep blue water in front of the house. Most of the beach community wasn't up yet. A lone brown pelican was skimming the water. We held hands above the low waves. Everything was picture-postcard perfect. So why was I feeling as if there were a gaping hole where my heart ought to be? Why was I still obsessed with Casanova? "You're thinking bad thoughts, aren't you?" Kate bumped me hard with her hip. "You're on vacation. Think vacation thoughts." "Actually, I was thinking very good thoughts, but they made me feel bad," I told her. "I know that crazy-ass song," she said. She gave me a hug to reassure me that we were both in this thing together, whatever it was that we were in. "Let's take a run. I'll race you to Coquina Beach," she said. "Ready, set, prepare yourself to lose." We started to jog. Kate showed no signs of a limp. The pace picked up. She was so strong, in all ways. We both were. At the end, we were running nearly full out, and we collapsed in a wall of silver-blue surf. "I didn't want to lose, Kate," I was thinking as I ran. "I didn't want this to end. I didn't know what to do about it." On a warm, breezy Saturday night, Kate and I lay on an old Indian blanket on the beach. We were talking on 50 subjects at one sitting. We had already feasted on roast Carolina duckling with blackberry sauce that we'd made together. Kate had on a sweatshirt that read, "Trust me, I'm a doctor." "I don't want this to end either," Kate said, with a heavy sigh. Then, "Alex, let's talk about some of the reasons we both believe this has to end." I shook my head and smiled at her characteristic directness. "Oh, this will never really end, Kate. We'll always have this time. It's one of those special treasures you get every once in a while in life." Kate grabbed and held my arm with both her hands. Her deep brown eyes were intense. "Then why does it have to end here?" We both knew some, though not all, of the reasons. "We're too much alike.
We're both obsessively analytical. We're both so logical that we know the half-dozen reasons this won't work out. We're stubborn, and we're strong-willed. Eventually, we would go boom, I said in a half-teasing tone.
Sounds like the old self-fulfilling prophecy to me, Kate said.
We both knew I was telling the truth, though. Sad truth. Is there such a thing? I guess that there is.
We just might go boom, Kate said, and she smiled sweetly. Then we couldn't even be friends. I couldn't stand the idea of losing you as my friend. That's still part of it for me. I can't risk a big loss yet.
We're both physically too strong. We'd kill each other eventually, Nidan, I told her. I was trying to lighten things up. She squeezed me a little tighter.
Don't make jokes about it. Don't make me laugh, damn you, Alex. I want this to be our sad time, at least. It's so sad I might cry. No, I am. See that?
It is sad, I said to Kate. It's the saddest thing. We lay on the scratchy wool beach blanket and held each other until the morning. We slept under the stars and listened to the steady beat of the Atlantic. Everything seemed gently touched with the brush of eternity that night on the Outer Banks. Well, almost everything. Kate turned to me in between catnaps, in between dreams.
Alex, is he coming after us again? He is, isn't he?
I didn't know for sure, but that was the plan. Chapter 121.
Tick-cock, tick-cock, tick-cock.
He was still obsessed with Kate McTiernan, only it was much more disturbing and complex than just the fate of Dr. Kate now. She and Alex Cross had conspired to ruin his unique creation, his precious and very private art, his life as it had been. Nearly everything that he'd ever loved was gone now, or in disarray. It was time for a comeback. Time to show them once and for all. Time to show his true face. Casanova realized that he missed his best friend above all else. That was proof that he was sane after all. He could love. He could feel things. He had watched in disbelief as Alex Cross shot down Will Rudolph on the streets of Chapel Hill. Rudolph had been worth 10 Alex Crosses, and now Rudolph was dead. Rudolph had been a rare genius. Will Rudolph was Jekyll and Hyde, but only Casanova had been able to appreciate both sides of his personality. He remembered their years together and couldn't put them out of his thoughts anymore. They had both understood that exquisite pleasure intensified the more it was forbidden. That was a ruling principle behind the hunts, the collection of bright, beautiful, talented women, and eventually the long string of murders. The unbelievable, matchless thrill of breaking society's sacred taboos, of living out elaborate fantasies, was absolutely irresistible. These were pleasures not to be believed. So were the hunts themselves, the choosing, observing, and taking of beautiful women and their most personal possessions. But now, Rudolph was gone. Casanova understood that he wasn't merely alone. He was suddenly afraid to be alone. He felt as if he'd been cut in half. He had to take control again. That's what he was doing now. He had to give Alex Cross some credit. Cross had come close to catching him. He wondered if Cross knew how close. Alex Cross was obsessed. That was his edge and all the others in the chase. Cross would never give up, not until he was killed. Cross had set up this delicious little trap in Nag's Head for him, hadn't he? Of course he had. Cross had figured that he would come after him and Kate McTiernan anyway, so why not have it happen under controlled circumstances? Why not, indeed? It was almost a full moon the night he arrived at the Outer Banks. Casanova could make out two men in the tall, wavering dune grass up ahead. They were the FBI agents assigned to watch over Cross and Dr. Kate, the hand-picked guardians. He flicked on his flashlight so that the two of them would see him coming. Yes, he could fit in anywhere. That was just part of his genius, though. Just a small part of his act. When he got within voice range, Casanova called out to the agents.
Yo, it's only me.
He tilted the flashlight upward to expose his face. He let them see him, see who he was.
Tick-tock.
Chapter 122. It was my morning to take care of our breakfast, and I democratically decided on Kate's favorite sticky buns to top off my infamous Monterey Jack cheese and sautéed onion omelet. I figured I would jog to and from the tiny overpriced bakery in Nag's Head. Jogging helps me think in straight lines sometimes. I ran on a zigzag path through softly waving waist-high dune grass that eventually met with the paved road over the marshes and into town. It was a beautiful late summer day. I began to relax as I jogged. My guard was down, so I almost didn't see him. A blonde man in a navy blue windbreaker and stained khaki pants lay spread-eagled in the tall grass, just off the dirt path. He looked as if his neck had been broken. He hadn't been dead very long. His body was still warm when I felt for a pulse. The dead man was FBI. He was a pro who wouldn't have been easy to take out. He had been stationed out here to watch over Kate and me, to help trap Casanova. The plan was Kyle Craig's, but Kate and I had agreed to it. Oh, God damn it, no, I groaned. I took out my gun and began to sprint back to the house and Kate. She was in terrible danger. We both were. I tried to concentrate on thinking like Casanova, on what he might do next, what he was capable of doing. Clearly the perimeter defense around the house had been broken. How did he keep doing that? Who the hell was he? Who did I have to fight? I wasn't expecting the second body and almost tripped over it. It was hidden in the dune grass. The agent also wore a navy blue windbreaker. He was lying on his back and his red hair was neatly combed. There was no sign of a struggle. His lifeless brown eyes were staring up at circling gulls and a buttery yellow sun. Another FBI bodyguard dead. I was in a panic now as I raced through the stiff wind and flowing grass to the beach house. It was quiet and still, just as I had left it. I was almost certain that Casanova was already there. He had come hunting for us. It was payback time. He had to get this just right, didn't he? He had to make it perfect. Or maybe he just needed revenge for Rudolph. I raised my Glock pistol and went cautiously inside the front screen door. Nothing moved in the living room. The only sound was the ancient refrigerator humming in the kitchen, singing like a nest of insects.
"Kate!"
I yelled at the top of my lungs.
"He's here! Kate! Kate, he's here! Casanova is here!"
I rushed through the living room to the first-floor bedroom and flung open the door. She wasn't in there. Kate wasn't where I had left her minutes ago. I ducked into the hallway again. A closet door opened suddenly. A hand reached out and grabbed me. I swung hard to my right. It was Kate. The look on her face was one of determination and sheer hatred. I saw no fear in her eyes. She put her finger to her lips.
"Shh, shh,"
she whispered.
"I'm okay, Alex."
"Me too, so far." We proceeded in lockstep toward the kitchen, where the house phone was located. I had to get the Cape Hatteras police here now. They would contact Kyle and the FBI. It was dark in the narrow hallway, and I didn't see the flash of metal until it was too late. A sharp pain shot through me as a longish dart stuck into the left side of my chest. It was a heart shot, perfectly delivered. He'd hit me with a state-of-the-art tensor stun gun. A powerful shock of electrical current streaked through my body. My heart fluttered. I could smell my own flesh burning. I don't know how I did it, but I went at him. That's the problem with stun guns. Even an expensive 80,000-volt tensor. They don't always bring down a big man, especially a crazed one with a sense of purpose. I didn't have enough strength left. Not for Casanova. The agile and powerful killer sidestepped me and chopped my neck hard. He hit me a second time and brought me to my knees. He wore no mask this time. I looked up at him. He had a light beard now, like Harrison Ford's at the start of The Fugitive. His brown hair was slicked straight back, longer now and unruly. He was letting himself go a little bit. Was he mourning his best friend? No mask. He wanted me to see who he was. His game had been destroyed, hadn't it? Here was Casanova, finally. I had been close with Davy Sykes. I felt sure it had to be someone connected with the Durham police force. I felt it was someone attached to the original Golden Couple murder case. He had covered every trace, though. He'd had alibis that made it impossible for him to be the killer. He had figured everything out so beautifully. He was a genius. That was why he had succeeded for such a long time. I stared into the impassive face of Detective Nick Ruskin. Ruskin was Casanova. Ruskin was the beast. Ruskin, Ruskin, Ruskin. I can do anything I want to do. Don't you forget that, Cross, Ruskin said to me. He had been so perfect at his art. He had fit in, blended so well, created the best possible facade as a detective, the local star, the local hero, the one most above suspicion. Ruskin stepped toward Kate as I lay helpless from the tensor dart. I missed you, Katie. Did you miss me? He laughed easily as he spoke. There was madness in his eyes, though. He had finally gone over the edge. Was it because his twin was dead? What in hell did he want to do now? So, did you miss me? He repeated as he came toward her with the powerful, incapacitating tensor in hand. Kate didn't answer the question. She went for him instead. She'd wanted this for so long. An explosive kick to Casanova's right shoulder spun the gun from Nick Ruskin's outstretched hand. The kick was a beauty, perfectly delivered. Hit him again, then get out of there, I wanted to yell at Kate. I couldn't speak yet. Nothing came out when I tried. I finally managed to get up on one elbow. Kate was flowing the way she did when she practiced on the beach. Casanova was a big man, powerful, but Kate's strength seemed to surge from a rage equal to his. He comes, we tangle, she had said once upon a time. She was a blur, a perfect fighter, even better than I expected. I didn't see the next punch. I was blocked by his body. I saw Nick Ruskin's head snap sharply to the side, and his long hair flew out in every direction. His legs wobbled badly. She'd hurt him. Kate pivoted and hit him again. A lightning-quick punch caught the left side of his face. I wanted to cheer for her. The punch didn't stop him, though. Ruskin was relentless, but so was she. He lunged at her, and Kate hit him yet again. His left cheek appeared to collapse. It was a mismatch all the way. She crunched a hard fist into his nose, and he went down. He moaned loudly. He was beaten. He wasn't getting up again. Kate had won. My heart was thundering inside my chest. I saw Ruskin reaching for his ankle holster. Casanova wasn't going to lose to a woman or anyone else. The gun appeared like some clever sleight-of-hand trick. It was a semi-automatic, Smith & Wesson. He was changing the rules of the fight.
No,
Kate shouted at him.
Hey, asshole, I said in a hoarse whisper. I was changing the rules, too.
Casanova turned. He saw me and pivoted the semi-automatic in my direction. I was holding the Glock with both hands. My arms were shaking some, but I was able to sit up. I emptied almost a full clip into him. Drive a stake through his heart. That's what I did. Casanova flew back hard against the wall of the house. His body thrashed. His legs didn't work. Numbness was already spreading through his body. The expression on his face was one of shock. He realized he was human after all. His eyeballs seemed to float upward and disappear into the top of his head. Only the whites of his eyes showed. His legs kicked, kicked again, then stopped. Casanova died almost instantly on the beach house floor. I stood up on rubbery legs. I noticed that I was glazed with sweat, icy cold, unpleasant as hell. I struggled over to Kate, and we held on to each other for a long time. We were both trembling with fear, but also triumph. We had won. We had beaten Casanova.
I hated him so much, Kate whispered. I never even understood the word before.
I telephoned the Cape Hatteras police. Then I called the FBI and my kids and Nana in Washington. It was finally over. Chapter 123, The Last Chapter. I sat on the familiar sun porch of my home sweet home in Washington. I was sipping a cold beer with Samson. It was fall, and the crisp, cool bite of winter was already in the air.
Our beloved and despised Redskins were already in football training camp. The Orioles were out of the pennant race again. And so it goes, Kurt Vonnegut wrote once upon a time, when I was at Johns Hopkins and susceptible to such easy, breezy sentiments. I could see my kids in the living room. They were on the couch together, watching Beauty and the Beast for the 11th time. I didn't mind. It was a good, strong story, and it bore repeating. Tomorrow it would be Aladdin again, my personal favorite. I saw today that D.C. deploys 3 times as many police as the national average, Sampson was telling me. Yeah, but we have 20 times as much crime. We didn't get to be the capital city of America for nothing, I said. Like one of our past mayors said, outside of the killings, Washington has one of the lowest crime rates in the country. Sampson laughed. We both did. Life was finally returning to normal.
You all right? Sampson asked me after a while.
He hadn't asked that since I'd been back from the South, from the Outer Banks, my summer vacation, as I called it.
I'm just fine. I'm a big, macho, kick-ass detective like you.
You're a lying sack of shit, Alex. 10 pounds in a 1-pound bag. That, too, goes without saying. I admitted to my faults with him.
I asked you a serious damn question, he said. He was giving me a flat, cold stare from behind his shades. Kind of reminded me of Hurricane Carter when he was a fighter.
You miss her, man?
Of course I miss her. Hell yes. I told you that I'm all right, though. I never had a woman friend like that.
You?
No. Not like that. You understand that both of you are very odd?
He shook his head and didn't know what to make of me. I didn't either. She wants to set up practice where she grew up. She made a promise to her family. That's what she's decided to do for the time being. I need to be here right now. Make sure you grow up all right. That's what I decided to do. That's what we decided together down in Nag's Head. It's the right thing.
Uh-huh.
It's the right thing, John. It's what the two of us decided. Sampson sipped his beer thoughtfully, as us macho men often do. He rocked in his easy chair and watched me suspiciously over the mouth of the beer bottle. He watched over me, is what he did. Later that night, I sat all alone on the porch. I played Judgment Day, then God Bless the Child on the piano. I thought about Kate again and about the thorny subject of loss. Most of us learn to deal with it somehow. We get better at it anyhow. Kate had told me a powerful story while we were in Nag's Head. She was a good storyteller, a reincarnated Carson McCullers. When she was 20, she said, she learned that her father was tending bar in a honky-tonk near the Kentucky border, and she went to the bar one night. She told me that she hadn't seen her father in 16 years. She sat in the seedy, bad-smelling bar and watched him for almost half an hour. She hated what she saw. Finally, she left without ever introducing herself to her own father, without even telling him who she was. Kate just left. She was so tough, and mostly in good ways. That was how she had survived all of those deaths in her family. It was probably why she was the one who had escaped from Casanova's house. I remembered what she had told me. Just one night, Alex. A night neither of us would ever be able to forget. I hadn't been able to forget it. I hoped Kate hadn't either. As I stared out the porch window into the darkness, I couldn't shake the eerie feeling that I was being watched. I solved the problem in true doctor detective fashion. I stopped staring out the grime-stained window. I know they are out there, though. They know where I live. I finally went up to bed, and had no sooner fallen off to sleep when I heard a banging sound in the house. Loud banging. Persistent noise. Trouble. I grabbed my service revolver and hurried downstairs, where the banging noise continued. I glanced at my wristwatch. It was 3:30. A witching hour. Trouble for me. I found Sampson lurking at the back door. He was the noisemaker.
"There's been a murder," he said as I unlocked, unchained, and opened up for him. This one is a honey, Alex.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Kiss the Girls, written by James Patterson, read by Michael Kramer. Kiss the Girls is also available in print and as an ebook from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 1995 by James Patterson. Audio production copyright 1995, Books on Tape, all rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher is unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.